Last weekend, 32 people wound up in the hospital after a deck collapsed in Montana. Deck collapse is more common than we'd like to think. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, will be here. We'll talk about how to make sure your deck is structurally sound and what to do if it's not. We'll also talk about some do's and don'ts when it comes to deck upgrades. And Bill will answer your questions about the projects on your to-do list. 866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Building a deck is a common do-it-yourself project, but apparently it's also pretty common for decks to be unsafe or unreliable. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today to talk with us about decks. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Charity. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, good. Happy summer.
Yeah, you too. So are you joining us today from your deck?
No, you wouldn't let me because of all the birds that I have, and they'd make too much noise. So, no, I'm actually sitting inside watching it, raining a little bit. But and just to keep Dennis happy, and neither one of my mowers are running right now, so I don't have to worry about getting hurt.
All right. That's excellent news. Just let the grass grow. All right. So
yeah.
this story that's been getting a lot of press about this deck collapse in Montana, that was at a commercial building. So that was at a lodge. And that's kind of a different issue than a home deck. But that has shed light on the fact that a lot of decks collapse or cause injury in any given year. What are you concerned about?
Well, you know, in that case, it makes it even scarier because on commercial jobs or commercial applications, you know, there's usually an architect, an engineer, and a lot of inspections, and they have, you know, they usually build to a lot higher standard than many of the, you know, the residential decks. And for those to fail, it really makes you pause and think about, well, you know, what kind of shape is my deck in? And on, you know, the last week I was watching a show that they said that, you know, roughly 50% of all decks are basically underbuilt or, you know, built not to to codes. And it's just, you know, that's a really scary topic because, you know, we a lot of times just assume that, you know, since the house hopefully has a 100-year life, that the deck is going to have one. And, you know, especially here in Iowa, where we go through these dry, wet, and, you know, we have shade and sun and you know, and wood. It just moves all over the place and has a tendency to, you know, get wet and rot. And even when we have, let's say, you know, a deck, man-made decking underneath, it's usually wood. And there we've learned that what we did in the past, especially from the 90s on back, you know, we just were building some decks that you just think about it and, you know, the hair goes up on the back of your neck.
So, all right, a lot of us have probably moved into homes with decks. We don't necessarily know if they were built by a contractor or if they were a do-it-yourself project. So a lot of us don't know a whole lot about our decks, or maybe we built it ourselves and we still don't know
right.
A whole lot about our decks. What do you do to try to identify if you could have problems?
Well, you know, I think probably one of our best sources is for everybody to get a copy, you know, download or have somebody download you a copy of the, it's the American Wood Council has a prescriptive residential wood deck construction guide. And the new 2017 is online now. You know, it's roughly a 40-some page manual. And if you're going to build a deck, especially now, you know, you would want to follow that. But it's also a good guide to go back and look at maybe what your deck that you have right now, where it may be a little bit maybe underbuilt, or you can, you know, really inspect it, you know, look for, say, rotten wood or wrong fasteners by following this guide and see, well, what kind of fasteners or what kind of wood how is everything attached according to this guide and how mine is. And it'll kind of open your eyes as to, okay, yeah, this just is a little bit scary. So you want to have something to go by, and that's probably the best one to look at, because it follows the residential building code. And so between that and possibly having your local building inspector come by and take a look at it, if you're in a community, have the building inspector come by and take a look at it. Or a very reliable builder. But I was looking at the new codes even today, and I think, some of the things have really changed here in the last few years.
When a house is inspected, when a house is sold, do you think the deck gets a lot of attention?
You know, not near enough, not near enough at all, because when I go out and look at buildings, a lot of times I'll look at the deck for people, and what I see is really scary, because back in the 70s, especially if you have a deck that maybe from the 80s and 70s, then it may still be there, it may not, but some of the ways that we attach the deck to the house, there's a board that goes onto the house called the ledger board. And the way we attached that board to the house, a lot of builders are still doing it the way we did in the 70s. We just found the biggest doggone nails we had, you know, in the truck or something, and used a lot of nails and think, oh, okay, that's going to hold just fine. Well, we always thought about, you know, when you go out into a deck, you're standing on it. So you're thinking of weight going downwards, you know, all the weight pushing down. Most decks fail because the deck pulls away from the house. So a lot of builders don't think about, they call that a lateral load. So when you walk out or the wind's pushing on and it's moving like left to right, and when people go out, the amount of times, the accumulated times that people go out, stop, lean on the end of their deck, you know, that pushes just, it doesn't seem like a lot, but it's enough to maybe pull things away. And so we go back and look at how is that ledger board attached to the house, and what is it attached into, and then how are all those floor joists, you know, that the decking is sitting on, how are they attached? And we go back, and that's the area that I usually look at, because I look at the fasteners. I look at what kind of nails did they use, or screws or bolts. And there's been, you know, most people have like treated wood decks. And when they changed about, I think it was 2004, 2005, they changed to a different type of treated lumber, and there's a lot of copper in it. So when you mix galvanized nails or aluminum with the copper that's in the treated lumber, and then if there's any moisture, you get electrolysis, you know, which, you know, like is like a battery. So when you have these two different metals and with water, they react and they start to corrode and decay. And I've been on some places where the fasteners are almost corroded away after 7 years. And we have to really look at what fasteners are designed for the type of wood that you have and the type of hangers. And most of the time it's just reading directions, you know, reading directions on the wood or reading directions on the fasteners. They'll say that, you know, this nail, even though it's galvanized, doesn't mean that it's hot dipped galvanized. It may be electro-galvanized, which doesn't have the same amount of galvanizing, which is, you know, when you look at a galvanized nail, it's usually silver. And, you know, the amount of galvanizing that stops the decay, but when it mixes with copper and water, again, if it's not the proper type, it decays. And there's just all these little things that add up, and that's what's causing some of these newer failures, that good wood and good construction, but our fasteners, because we haven't been doing enough research, we haven't been keeping up on, you know, what's actually holding that deck together.
If, I mean, you're talking about relatively new decks developing this problem. If your deck
right.
is over a certain age, does that give you pause?
Yeah, you know,
and
if it's over 10
that
years,
age? Okay, 10 years.
Yeah, you know, if it's been up for 10 years, you may want to start looking at it. You know, when we would, let's say when we would screw treated wood decking down into treated wood floor joists, the ends of the boards, you know, a lot of times they will start to rot out because moisture will go into the end cut, because that's how moisture travels on wood. It doesn't really go down into the wood from, say, the top of the board. It goes in through the ends and starts to rot. Well, the ends are what are, you know, sitting on top of the floor joist, so you may be just walking along on somebody's deck, and then you get to the end of the deck board where the end of that particular board may be rotted, and all of a sudden that'll snap, and you're, because of your weight, it will just drop you right down, you know, down to your knees or so. So you really want to go in there and, you know, take a screwdriver or a scratch awl or, you know, a pocket knife and poke around on the wood and see if, you know, you find any soft spots. And if you can get underneath the deck, look to see if where the floor joists meet the house, you want to see if there's been any movement, like the floor joists have maybe moved a little bit, where there's a gap between the floor joist and that ledger board, or look for water damage. In the 70s and 80s, we didn't know how to stop water from, you know, getting underneath your patio door. Almost every one of them has been replaced by now. Or we would use aluminum flashing and lay it over top of treated lumber, and then treated lumber would rot the flashing out, and we'd have the water issues. So you really want to get in there and look for wet spots, damp spots, movement, you know, maybe find a place in your yard where you can use your eye as basically like a level, is use your eye and look across the boards and you know, see if there's high spots, low spots, maybe dips in your framing. Look at the posts to see if there's rot at the bottom. I have, when I do presentations, I have this treated 4x4, you know, 3.5 inch by 3.5 inch. I have a little chunk of it. And it's, you know, it's treated lumber, and I, you know, I'll hold it up and I'll say, here's, take a look at this piece of treated wood. And then I'll hold it up and they can see the end of it, which at the time was the bottom of the post where it sat on concrete. The whole inside of that 4x4 is rotted up about 2 inches up inside, but the outside edges of it where the treatment was only went in maybe a quarter of an inch. That's still there, but the whole inside is gone because there was no treatment to stop, you know, decay. So a lot of the posts that we have, when we would cut them, we wouldn't put, you know, a treatment on the cut. And so the bottom of your post may be rotting from the inside, but it doesn't look like it, you know, until you start maybe probing it. So there's a lot of hidden things, and it's good to do some research and, you know, take a look at that guide and just look at your deck and see how can I upgrade it. And it may be time, if it's 20 years old or 15 years old, it may be time to replace it.
All right. And I'm sufficiently scared already, Bill, but we also need to take a
close look. Oh, we got more. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to take a close look at the railings, of course, as well. Make sure that if you lean on something, it's not going to collapse. But we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And Bill is also here to answer your questions about the home improvement projects on your list. Maybe you just added one to your list in the last 15 minutes. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bill McAnally is our home improvement expert. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is on the line with us today, and he is here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bill, we're going to start with a question from Mary in Des Moines. She says, our house is 25 years old. I wonder if the insulation in the attic is adequate or still doing its job. When I look at it, I don't know how to evaluate it or what to look for. So she has multiple questions for you. Who should she get to look at it? If she needs more insulation, what kind should she get? And I'll ask the other questions as follow-ups.
Yeah, you know my memory. So, you know, when you go up and look at an attic, we always used to think, you know, let's just add some more insulation. And what we found in the last few years, it's the biggest thing you can do is air seal the attic. And in fact, in Minnesota, you can't add any more insulation in your attic or you're not supposed to, but you don't add any more insulation in the attic until you air seal the attic separation point between the interior of the house and the attic. So normally, you know, that would be the ceiling up above you. Because the insulation, really all it does is, you know, help stop thermal transfer of temperatures, you know, to keep your attic cold and the inside of the house warm. But we have so many air leaks, say around where wires go up into the attic, where lights opening were cut through the drywall. There's just an unbelievable amount of holes that go up in there. And for the insulation to do its job, it can't have that air moving through it. So it's more important that you air seal first. In fact, we're doing some trainings and throughout the state, hopefully starting up this fall, of showing people how to air seal and then insulate. So what you want to do is you want to look at, you know, if you have, you know, let's say a foot of insulation or more in the attic, you know, you probably have attic, you know, adequate, but still it's not performing, right? So if you want to really get performance, you would air seal, and then you can add some more insulation. You want an R value of roughly an R49. And what you would do is look at normally cellulose is used. I think it performs a little bit better than blown fiberglass in the attic. Both cellulose and fiberglass are blown. If you have, say, fiberglass bats, which are maybe pieces that are 16 inches wide, and they're laid in between the ceiling joists in your attic, they don't really perform all that well because there's so many gaps in between the joints. So what you'd want to do is call someone that is just an insulation professional, someone that they install insulation for a living, and ask them about the importance of air sealing. And to me, if they say, oh, well, it really doesn't matter, then I'd move on to the next person. Because they haven't been keeping up with building science and the requirements of construction. I still think that the blown fiberglass, like I said a little bit ago, or blown cellulose is a better product. It has a higher density and it's not as clean looking, but when you fill in all the gaps in your air seal, then you'll have a very good performing attic. And also, you know, you are required to have ventilation in your attic, so you want to make sure that person that installs the insulation understands, you know, how the air that's going to get up into the attic, how it's going to get out. But
but you also need to create a breathable structure. So that's different.
You're separating. You know, it's two different environments, and there's a whole. That particular thing is maybe changing here in about 3 or 4 more years. So keep you posted on that about how much attic ventilation you really need to have. But you need to hire a professional. Let's get to that next.
The next question is, okay, I need to hire a professional. How do I even look for somebody who specializes in insulation? And how do you find somebody who's reputable?
Well, you know, you want to find somebody that's been around for a long time. Get a lot of references, you know, basically like anything else, but you want to find somebody that specializes in insulation and ask them what kind of training that they've gone through for their particular brand of insulation. Some people will just crawl up in the attic, and it's sad to say, but some people will crawl up in the attic and they will just spray enough insulation so when you maybe pop your head up, it looks fine. You want to make sure that they document everything in the attic. What we usually ask them to do is to install these little paper rulers that they would set down onto the ceiling, and then they go up in the attic. They stick up about 2 feet or so, and then they every 20 square feet, there's one of these rulers, and then they would, you know, spray the insulation to that. So, you know, you would assume that they put the insulation to that level.
But you really want to
ask around, go to lumber yards, but you can just on the internet, you can find insulation contractors in the state of Iowa. Make sure they're insured, because that's a little scary, because when they crawl up in your attic, they can hit some insulation or hit some wiring. You know, they could put their foot through the ceiling, which has happened before. And, how's that going to get paid for? The other thing is, you know, her house isn't that old, but if your house is older and it has the old knob and tube wiring in it, that black wiring that goes from little porcelain knobs, if that insulation is still working or that wiring is still working, then you cannot add any insulation on top of it until that is either replaced or you build something like a drywall box around it. No insulation can touch the old knob and tube wiring.
All right. So get lots and lots of references. And let's get to the phones now. Cecile is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Cecile.
Hi. I have two questions. I'll start with the easier one first. I live in a 100-year-old house. About 2 years ago, the roof was re-roofed. And only afterwards did we realize that, well, the gutters are sort of leaky, but now the straps that hold the gutter are underneath the new roofing. Is there any way to work on the gutters without destroying the roofing? That's the first question.
Did you put asphalt shingles on?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, most of the time, repairmen or handyman can actually get up there, and yeah, they can work on those straps, especially on a warmer day,
okay.
Where they can lift it, and they can reinstall the straps. I wouldn't worry about that.
Okay, good. The second question is concerns an old cistern that we have near the house that we had. I wanted to use to water the garden with during dry periods, so we had a sump pump put in it to pump out the water, and it worked fine when we tried it. A couple of weeks later, we went in to use it, and no water came out, lifted up the lid of the cistern and saw that the sump pump was well above the water level in the cistern, and so I assume there's a leak in it. I'm getting a little moisture along the base of the part of the basement that's located closest to that cistern. Could it be that the cistern is leaking water in and that's filtering into the basement?
Yeah, very easily.
How do I find someone who can fix it?
Well, you know, I would get a person that does excavation. And I would have them. I really don't care for cisterns that well because of what happens there. You know, let's say you start pumping water. Well, then water starts flowing to it. And a lot of times, if there was, the water will flow into the cistern. You start opening up these little veins in the soil for the water to flow easier and easier because you're sucking on it. You know, pulling the water to the cistern. And then if you shut the pump off, well, then the water sitting there, a lot of times since you've opened the veins up, you may have opened up some veins that were maybe kind of clogged, and now it's going kind of flowing to the basement like it maybe used to. I just like to see those plugged up because they make me real nervous also as well. People walking around, let's say you sell the place and the top caves in and somebody falls into
well,
it.
Well, it's got a cast. It's got a cast iron top, and it sits up above ground level, so no one's going to fall into it, and it takes a lot of effort to lift the lid off.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's just, you know, sometimes it's a personal choice, I guess, you know, but if you keep getting water there and it just started because of the cistern, I think I'd stop using it. But, you know, I just am always looking at down the road, too, you know, like, say, next owner. I don't know what kind of shape it's in. I would rather see an above ground storage, you know, water storage than something in the ground, especially if it's over 100 years old.
Okay. Well, so who would deal with emptying it out or filling it in or what?
A lot of times landscapers can do that because they have small machinery. They have small excavators that they can get in there and dig that out and fill that in. I know a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but I always kind of look at, you know, if I don't know that concrete's safe, and I don't know what kind of shape it is. I know everything up above ground might be fine, but I'm always nervous about those things. And so, somebody with a small excavator. Oh, well, you know, yeah, I know. In fact, I had at my own house, there was an old metal septic tank. And when I was digging up for the house, I thought it was substantial. And then, boy, it was just like paper thin when we started working on it. So, but like I say, an excavator or a landscaper, can probably take care of that. But you know, if not, you know, maybe you're going to have some foundation work done. you know, to alleviate that water issue.
All right, Cecile, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Mark in Urbandale at 866-780-9100. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, I've got a question about a deck. 2 years ago, we upgraded a deck in to put some new railings on it, aluminum railings. And at the time, they suggested that we upgrade the support posts from 4x4s to 6x6s, which we did.
Right.
One, and this is treated lumber, and everything looked fine when we put it in. But one of the supports, parallel with the grain, is starting to show like 6 to 7 inch shakes or splits. They're random, but parallel to the grain. And the post has also torqued, twisted a little bit. Should I replace that?
Well, you know, that's the downside. I'm glad you said 6x6 because the new codes are requiring that, you know, they be 6x6 to hold your deck up.
Right.
So whoever built it, you know, did their research. That's some of the problems with treated lumber, especially posts. They just seem to want to twist. They want to, you know, delaminate a little bit, and they're always, you know, they just seem to, they look great when you put them in, and you never know what's going to happen to them once the sun starts drying them out. You know, if most of it's just cosmetic.
But it's only affected the one.
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't be too worried about it unless it's, you know, really starts to develop a bow or something, which going to affect its height. But I wouldn't be too worried about it. But if it's cosmetic, if it bothers you, I'd replace it.
Okay.
We
just maybe just put some caulk in it and paint it over because they are painted.
Oh yeah, sure. Oh yeah, you can do that. I wouldn't worry about that.
It's torquing along the vertical axis. It's off maybe 15 degrees. Is that any cause for concern?
I don't think it is. You know, an engineer may tell you different. I don't really think it is. What does kind of concern me is how they attach the aluminum to the treated deck. Because aluminum and the new treated wood, they don't get along real good. I keep my eye on how those are attached. Look for any corrosion or something where the aluminum is attached to the treated lumber. If that's the way I have it in my mind, if that's going on.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for your call. And we've got another question about decks. This one from Don in Ames. Hi, Don.
Oh, hi. I was looking for a source of a good review of synthetic deck materials. I checked Consumer Reports, and they don't have much. And if you go to the sites of the people that make it, they tend to be mostly positive stuff.
All right, so a good critique of synthetic deck materials.
Yeah, I would. What I would do is I kind of go by, look at like Inspectopedia. It's a site that building inspectors use, and there's the National Association of Housing Inspectors. I would go that route because they're the ones that actually see things and they inspect decks, and they would give you, you know, that would really be a good third party because they'll tell you, okay, I'm seeing this, and then other inspectors kind of chime in and say, okay, I'm seeing the same thing with that particular product. You're really going to get an unbiased, opinion on which ones work. And it's funny you bring that up because I've looked for the same thing. It's really hard to get a third party opinion on a lot of these products. And a lot of it is because of climates. You know, when you're in a southern climate as opposed to, say, a northern climate like we are, those products behave completely different. And, you know, when we're looking at applying them on top of, say, treated lumber or cedar, or in some cases, you know, you're starting to see some steel decks, they all perform differently. You know, that's why I would kind of go and maybe look at these inspection sites, like just, you know, Google like building inspectors and deck failures or something like that. That's usually what I do. So, you know, the other thing that I'm seeing, and I kind of want to bring this up right now, I've seen some people, some companies that are recommending they use concrete pavers, you know, like brick pavers as your deck because it's low maintenance and it looks nice. And there are designed deck framings that are steel to carry brick pavers, but
if you're going to set brick pavers on top of a, you know, worst case scenario, a 10-year-old deck, because you don't want to have the synthetic decking or wood decking because of maintenance, you got to realize that these things may be 5 to 6 times heavier than what you have on there right now. And if your deck is marginal now, you could really be asking for problems. So if you're considering putting brick pavers on a deck, I would spend a lot of time. Yeah, thank you. I would spend a lot of time with an engineer beforehand, or just rip everything you've got and off and go with the steel deck, the steel framing that's designed to carry the pavers. That just scares the heck out of me.
Maybe go with a patio if you're looking for a paved surface. Huh?
I mean, that's like buying a concrete awning to put over your front deck, you know. Just, I'd be sitting there looking at that thing all the time waiting for it to drop, you know. So there's a lot of things coming out, so do your due diligence.
Well, it's frustrating because, of course, when you go to a home improvement store and you see a product, there is certainly a level of trust. You think, well, if they're selling this here, it must work.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I see railings, you know, you mentioned railings a little bit ago. When I see railings that are blatantly not built to code, because when you have a railing on your deck, first of all, it has to hold up to a 200-pound weight. So, you know, if you push 200 pounds against it, it's supposed to, you know, stand up straight and not move. Well, you know, okay, sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. But the spacing between, like, say, the balusters,
we're going to have to talk more about railings in just a moment. Okay. We'll be back in a moment with Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today, and he's here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we started the hour talking about the safety of decks. And, Bill, I had to interrupt your rant against unsafe railings. So let's pick up where we left off. What really worries you when you see railings on decks?
You let me stew there for a little bit over the break. You have to have a railing on a deck if it's like 30 inches or more off the ground. So that's kind of one requirement. But for the balusters, you're not supposed to be able to get anything larger than a 4-inch diameter sphere, like a small ball, which replicates a small child's head, through that baluster. So when you see these decorative, really cute railings that has like a wolf chasing a moose or something, you know, and there's all this space, and they market them and they put them up on these decks. I mean, that, to me, that's just an accident waiting to happen. So people have to realize that even if it's going horizontal, if the railing's going horizontal or vertical, I mean, the balusters or railing underneath it, you can't put, you know, anything smaller than, you know, or anything larger than 4 inches through that. They have to remember that. And I see that an awful lot, where they go more for looks because they want to be able to see what's out there. They don't think of the safety. And many times I've still seen people use benches instead of railings. And a bench has to still have a railing behind it. You know, people say, okay, I've made this really deep bench, there's no way anybody's going to fall off of it. Well, they still can. You still have to have that railing that can withstand that 200 pounds, be able, you know, not move it to be safe. So, you know, it has to be at least 36 inches tall, too. They can't be shorter so people can see stuff. So we kind of go for more for cosmetics, I think, a lot of times, instead of for safety.
All right. And you got to think about the squirreliest kid you know and the biggest person you know when you're thinking about the railing, right?
Yeah. Oh, and, you know, you start thinking about, if they're, you know, watching the Packers or something, and then they have a few beers or a little topsy-turvy, and all of a sudden, you know, a whole bunch of people are leaning on the railing, and you see that, you know, you can vision it so easy in your mind, a 4 or 5, you know, heavy-duty people that are maybe 200 and some pounds leaning on a rail, you know, and they're 10 feet off the ground. That would make me real nervous real fast.
So you have to kind of think a worst case scenario, and you still see people, hey, let's put a hot tub out there. And it's almost as bad as putting the pavers on there. You know, a hot tub is a tremendous amount of weight, and the deck may not be able to hold it. You may have to go and do a whole lot more framing. And, you know, Charity, some of the scariest things are when people hire someone and they assume that they know how to build a deck. I was on a place where they attached the floor joist. They put them up against the siding and used joist hangers to hold the floor joist, but it was nailed into the siding, which there was no board on the house they nailed them into, but they actually nailed the floor joist into the siding. And I thought, okay, how can anyone that has any kind of carpentry skills think that this is going to work? And it actually held up for a while. But it's those things are scary. You know, sometimes we assume that they have a name on their truck, that they know what they're doing, and in some cases they don't. Majority do, but some cases they don't.
All right. Let's get back to the phones here. We've got next Dennis. Oh, Dennis is – I'm not sure if he's there or not. Let's give him a try. Dennis in Polk City. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, great. Thanks for waiting. What's your question?
Well – well, we're talking about decks, and I'm just totally appalled on the code for the post decks. I see all these new post second story decks, and they use the 4x4s, which are 3.5 by 3.5. And what I've seen is after a while, these 4x4s have knots in them. Then they dry out, and the knots fall out, and these things are just like an accident waiting to happen. Why doesn't the code like require like a 6x6? And
Dennis, so if you could understand, yeah. Bill, he's concerned about the size of posts on decks. He sees a lot of 4x4s even on second floor decks, second story decks. And but you were just saying earlier that the code does require 6x6. Right?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things that I really noticed. And that's the one that, you know, I sent to you is that prescriptive guide, the 2017 and some of the earlier versions, they require 6x6s. So that's 5.5 inch by 5.5 inch posts. That's the smallest size you can use. And I'm right with him. I drive by and I see, you know, these huge decks, and I see these spindly little 4x4s, you know, holding this huge deck up. And it just scares me because, you know, he brought a really good point up. There's knots a lot of times in this wood. That's why you want to inspect the wood you're getting. If there's a big open knot in there, you would not use it to support a deck. You would set that off to the side and let somebody else cut it up for making pallets or something. You want to have good, clear lumber, but yet still, years ago, we were lifting a huge load using 6x6s, having a chain on it, and one of these 6x6s snapped. And inside the 6x6 was a knot that you couldn't see from the outside, about the size of a baseball. So that even though it looked like it was strong, it was not. And that's some things that you're dealing with wood. So like on my daughter's deck, I used a square steel channel, bolted down to concrete footings and bolted into the deck. I don't want, you know, we can park a semi on top of that deck. I don't ever want to have wood moving, twisting, and maybe failing. And he brought up a really good point, you know, that you still see a lot of decks that are way underbuilt. And I don't know if an inspector hasn't seen that, but one thing that would make me real nervous is that insurance company, if there is an issue, is an insurance company cover something that was not built to code or underbuilt? And you know how a lot of insurance companies are, you know, they would say, oh, sorry, you know, we're not going to cover it because it wasn't built to code.
All right. And we've got a couple more deck questions here. This one's from Steve. Okay. He said, how do you treat the ends of treated lumber when you're building a deck? What about the ends?
Yeah, you can go to paint stores, big box stores, anywhere. They have a treatment that you can paint on. In fact, that's what I did in a place up in Minnesota. All the six oak 6x6s that I have that are sitting on concrete, I treated the ends of those with a brush on, and I let it sit, kind of get pulled into the wood, hit it again, and a lot of times on the bottom of that wood, what I will do is I will take a piece of waterproofing membrane, like bitumen that you can buy, or ice and water shield. It's a product they use on roofs. That's a
basically an adhesive product. I put that on the end of the post so the water can't come up from the concrete footing or from the ground come into the end. To me, that's, I just want to prevent that moisture from coming into the end. But yeah, you can buy that in the paint department usually.
All right, and here's another question. This one is from Diane in Des Moines. What are your current recommendations for sealing an existing deck? We've used TWP in the past, but it's been a few years, and it's time to do it again. Do you have any thoughts on Prolux?
I have a friend that used, some of the newer products that are very thick, and basically put a heavy coating, fill in all the gaps in the wood, the nails, screw holes, everything. And he's had really good luck with it. And the reason I kind of like those type of products now is he's in Arkansas. This deck faces south, gets reflection off of a lake. I mean, it is the worst case scenario that I would think. And it was older treated lumber. It's nothing new. And it is really holding up better than I ever thought it would. But there again, you want to realize that once you coat it, you're kind of hiding what's underneath. So you coat the top, but yet underneath it still may have moisture issues. So you want to, before you coat something or paint something, you want to check the wood. And otherwise, Penofin oil works pretty well. Anything that has that in it, I would really look at going to the United States Forest Products Laboratories and get on their website and see what kind of products are actually working well for them, because they've tested all that in different applications. And I would go by their results rather than, the product manufacturer on seeing how good their product is.
Okay.
Because I've been wrong on that. I have a son-in-law keeps pointing out, it doesn't look as good as you said it would. So you're right. It doesn't. And yes, it's your deck, not mine.
All right. Here's a question from Kelly. She says, my house is only about 5 years old, but I noticed a dark area at the top of the post that holds up my sunroom. I'll check for soft spots tonight, but with a new house, having a rotting deck already seems unusual. What shortcuts could have been made that might cause this if it is rotting?
Well, if it is getting moisture, a lot of times it will turn dark because there again, it's the end of the board, and water can get in there. If it's 5 years, you may want to get a hold, if you know who the builder is, bring them over, or if you're in a community, you can get the local building inspector to take a look at it, because you shouldn't really be able to see the end of that post all that great, because there's supposed to be a fastener that connects the post to the beam that's sitting on top of it. You should only be able to see maybe two sides of it because of this attachment. But I would have someone, you go ahead and poke at it, but I would look at that prescriptive guide, that American Wood Council prescriptive guide, and see how all that was supposed to be attached. And if it isn't attached that way, I would have an inspector take a look at it.
All right, let's go
back.
That
really makes me nervous, is when, if she's seeing moisture now there, it can be coming from up above, it can be taking the beam out, water can getting in between the boards on the beam, and sometimes they fail pretty fast too.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Peter is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
We just bought a house, actually my son did, and the radon test came back at 6.
Okay.
And in the give and take in the purchase process, the seller has indicated that they're not willing to address that problem. And
okay.
So they also said that if we put a hood over the sump pump, it should resolve the matter, a ventilated hood.
Okay.
We were wondering what your thoughts were. Is 6 a bad number? We don't even know.
No. You get a lot of opinions on radon. The level, that you're supposed to take action or be concerned about is 4 picocuries per liter. It also depends where you take the test. If the test was taken right next to the sump pump, you can get anywhere from 0 to 300
parts per million. And then you go into another room in the basement, you may only get, like you said, six. If you have bedrooms down the basement or you spend a lot of time down in there, it all depends a lot of times on the lender and the insurance company. A lot of times a lender will not loan if it's over four. I don't like just putting that ventilated hood over the top because radon just doesn't come in there. It goes through the concrete and through the concrete walls and everything like it's not even there. So, but if you do vent, you probably will drop that number way down below six if they do just what you're saying. Me personally, I like radon mitigation systems for two reasons. The biggest reason to me is you are able to get rid of excess moisture in the basement and around the basement, because a radon mitigation system will pull the moisture from the grounds underneath your floor and around the foundation, pulls moisture vapor and vents it away. So basically what it's doing is drying your basement down. And they're a lot cheaper to run than a dehumidifier if you have a lot of moisture in your basement. Plus, it gets, you know, drops your radon level down. If you're going to be in that area a lot where it's six, it's totally up to you. I know Canada uses higher numbers. Six would pass in Canada. But a lot of times it depends on your vendor. But I would have them maybe do a longer-term test, check it again. It's always different in the winter than it is in the summer. It'll probably be higher in the winter, depends on when they test. But I would do something with it. I just like the mitigation systems because I think they should be in a house, and that's me personally. I think they should be in a house to help keep the house drier, you know, to keep that basement more livable. And they're usually like $1,500. But, yeah, it's going to be it may be a battle on the house for you. If you already moved into the house. Oh. He already moved in. Yeah.
No, he hasn't moved in yet. Okay.
Yeah. You know, it may just be something you can work back and forth on. But I'd get another test as well. And the lender, like I say, the lender may require something be done, that it be dropped down to four.
All right.
Four
well,
less.
Yeah. Peter, thanks a lot for your call. Let's try to slip one more call in here. Gene is on the line in Richland. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Question for Bill. It's about attic venting. Got a 20-year-old home, pretty well insulated, but I noticed it, and, you know, soffits and all that good stuff, but it doesn't have any kind of venting from one end to the other. And I wondered if that would be a good idea to add that. And I was thinking of powered, but the stuff I read says powered venting can pull your air conditioning out of your area down below,
yeah.
So don't do that.
Yeah, and that reinforces why you want to air seal the attic, so you're not pulling any air out of there. Does it have? So you don't have a ridge vent, right, at the very peak of the roof.
The ones
that go from end to end don't work the best. I mean, it's better than nothing, but it all depends too. Building pressures, outside pressures. That's why having a ridge vent works better than the ends, because when you go up in an attic a lot of times and you see moisture condensing, you know, up on the roof deck, it's climbing up between the rafters and it rises the highest spot, which is between the rafters, and it'll stay between those rafters till it gets to the top usually, or the moisture just drops. But it has a hard time getting from end to end. So, you know, actually ridge vents is a lot better system. That's the recommended system, is to have soffit and ridges. But you're right, you do not want to put a power vent up there, especially if you haven't air sealed, because it'll just be sucking everything out. I've got some great pictures of icicles hanging off of these things, and it's unbelievable.
We'll have to have a slideshow next time. Bill McAnally.
Oh, hey, there we go.
We are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks, Charity. Talk to you next month.
Yep. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a lovely afternoon.